This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. More and more companies and organizations these days are requiring their employees to participate in diversity, equity, and inclusion training. Since the 2020 police killing of George Floyd and the racial reckoning that followed, DEI training has grown into a global business worth as much as $9 billion. Here's Sharon Smith Akinsanya, CEO of Ray McKenzie Group, a diversity, equity, and inclusion consulting firm.
We've got a long way to go for inclusion. We've got to make some serious changes. We have to acknowledge that it happened, and we have to have the will to just decide that we're going to do better, that we're going to decide that we want an inclusive America and that we want an inclusive society that is fair.
In fact, this kind of training is hardly new. It dates back to the early 1960s with the passage of the Civil Rights Act. Title VII of the landmark law made it illegal for most employers to discriminate on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the act into law in 1964.
This Civil Rights Act is a challenge to all of us to go to work in our communities and our states, in our homes and in our hearts, to eliminate the last vestiges of injustice.
Back then, as companies worried about discrimination lawsuits, they began to train their workers in an effort to combat racism and make workplaces more inclusive and open to historically marginalized groups. That effort has continued for decades, but challenges around racial inequities in the workplace persist. For example, just back in 2018, two African-American men were arrested at a Starbucks in Philadelphia.
This video, captured by a witness's cell phone, shows police talking and later handcuffing the men while they were waiting for a friend. The men wanted to use the restroom, but the manager said that per store policy, they couldn't since they didn't buy anything. When they wouldn't leave, she called police.
In response, the company shut down more than 8,000 of its U.S. stores for a full day. The reason? Racial bias training for employees. Starbucks announced the move in a publicity video.
529 is an opportunity to renew our commitment to the third place, because we understand that racial and systemic bias have many causes, sources, and ways of showing up within each of us and in our communities.
But despite decades of efforts and billions of dollars spent, some critics say there's little evidence that mandatory DEI training is effective, and in some cases may be doing more harm than good. So what kind of DEI training actually works, and how do we measure that it works? This hour on Point, getting diversity, equity, and inclusion training right. And to start off, I'm joined now by Frank Dobbin. He's the chair of the Department of Sociology at Harvard University. He's also a co-author of the book, Getting to Diversity, What Works and What Doesn't, which was published in 2022. And Frank Dobbin, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Anthony.
So you studied what kinds of DEI training works versus what kinds don't work. So let's start with what doesn't work, according to your research. What do you see out there that gives you pause?
Well, the way we study what works and what doesn't work is by looking at the effects of training programs on the actual workforce in a company after a few years, 5 or 10 years later. We use data over 40 years, more than 800 companies. We also have big samples of universities. So we're looking at what really changes, not just attitudes or, say, the responses to a climate survey, what actually changes what the workforce looks like. And the results are kind of discouraging if you look at the kinds of diversity training most companies do. What most companies do is they have mandatory training for managers, where they begin trying to prove to managers that they're biased, and the next thing they do is they cover what the law prohibits. So they tell managers what they've been doing that is actually against the law. And unfortunately, that kind of training, while it's the most common sort of training, this legalistic, anti-bias, mandatory training targeting managers, it's the least effective. It actually has adverse effects on the composition of management jobs 5 or 10 years later.
So is that that's one of the basic questions I want to ask. What should it accomplish in your view? In other words, 5 or 10 years after a course or a series of courses on DEI training, what do we hope that it would accomplish?
Well, I mean, there are different ways people measure, and often they measure what's easy to measure, which is typically responses to the training itself. Did you like it? And then often they'll do before and after measures of actual bias, for example, in the sample of people who are in the training. I think it's more useful, we think, my co-author and I, Alexandra Kalev, we think it's more useful to study what happens to the workforce. So does the workforce become more diverse? Are more diverse people retained in the workforce? And there are a number of studies now looking at how different kinds of training programs affect the diversity of the workforce. And they just show that, again, this common sort of training is ineffective and actually leads to reductions in diversity. The reasons for that, I think, are pretty clear. Whites and white men in particular tend to react pretty negatively to diversity training. They feel that they're being put on the spot, accused of something that they're not guilty of, and then being told that the law tells them they can't do their jobs as they've always done them.
I want to just play some tape because one of the leading figures in anti-racist training is Robin DiAngelo. Her book, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, was a New York Times bestseller, surged in popularity again in the summer of 2020 after the killing of George Floyd. And DiAngelo gives workshops, speeches, lectures centered on white privilege or the innate advantages in society, which she argues white people have. So here she is explaining white privilege on CBS in 2020.
It doesn't matter if you agree with it, if you want it, if you even are aware of it. It's 24/7, 365. And one of the reasons why it's so hard for white people to see it, it serves us not to see it. We're told that we deserve it and that we earned it. And we take great umbrage when that is challenged. I'm not saying that white people don't struggle or face barriers or work hard, but there's a major barrier in this society, racism, that we don't struggle with. And not struggling against that barrier actually helps us navigate the barriers that we do struggle with.
So, Frank Dobbin, I'm just curious, you know, is that the kind of message that sometimes gets imbibed in these kinds of DEI trainings that turn people off and make them sort of push back against it?
It is. I mean, she's taking an approach that's been around really since the 1960s. The earliest diversity training sessions were about bias and how endemic it is and how hard it is to give up our biases. She's kind of taken it to a new level. DiAngelo, in her training sessions and in the book, she's really trying to get white people to accept that they're biased, and even white people who think they're not, who don't exhibit what we call explicit bias, don't respond to a questionnaire by saying they would never let their child date a person of color, for example.
But is that not true? I mean, isn't she trying to get at something that it may be uncomfortable, but it's a truth that we have to embrace?
It is a truth that it can be useful for people to embrace. But what research has suggested is that this approach is useful for the converts, that is, for white people who are already on board with the idea that they need to change and that they might harbor some implicit biases. I mean, we know from research on bias that people from all groups hold the same set of biases to different degrees, and they're just stereotypes about different groups. The question is that going to change things at work? And I think the problem with most diversity training is that people get 15 minutes online about bias and about their own biases, and it's not enough to really awaken people to essentially what we know about bias, the literature on bias. The literature just suggests that there are stereotypes, they're built up over a lifetime, and it's hard to change them. So, of course, if there are stereotypes in the society at large, most people hold them.
So what would you like to see companies do instead? Or what does your research show is more effective than this typical kind of mandatory DEI training?
Well, we look at different kinds of diversity training. First of all, it's better not to make it mandatory because that sends a signal that this is just about legal compliance. And it partly sends a signal that the company isn't really serious about trying to promote actual diversity of the workforce. They're just trying to check a legal box. It helps if the law is never mentioned. So one of the problems, one of the problems we see with most diversity trainings is people get the message that this is about the law, even if the law is only a small component of, say, an hour-long diversity training session. If there's 5 minutes about what's illegal, people take the message that this is really about legal compliance, and either they turn off or they understand that the company doesn't really care about this, that they're, again, just trying to check a legal box. What works much better is what I'll call cultural inclusion training, which is becoming increasingly popular. I think you'll hear more about that from some of the later guests. This is training where managers in particular are not told about the law. They're told about how to make the workplace more welcoming and inclusive to all kinds of different people. And that partly means listening to those people, trying to understand their problems at work, trying to understand how they see the workplace, trying to understand their hopes and desires for work. Mm-hmm. We find that that kind of training where managers are just open or trained to be open to different cultures and to different kinds of people, open to hearing what they have to say, actually has positive effects.
I'm intrigued, though, that one of the things you point to is the difference between mandatory and not mandatory. And I'm just wondering, if it's not mandatory, aren't you going to be leaving out the people who would probably most need to hear this message?
You know, one of the interesting things is that when companies transition from mandatory to non-mandatory training, they typically see similar numbers of people showing up. So even for mandatory training, people who are really opposed to it, they often find a way to not show up. So they just won't complete the online training and wait to see what happens, or they'll call in sick the day of the training. But ironically, there's some evidence that people who are most opposed to training are actually more likely to have adverse reactions to it.
All right. Well, we're going to pick up that after the break. We're talking to Frank Dobbin. He's chair of the Department of Sociology at Harvard. And we're looking at diversity, equity, and inclusion training. What works? What doesn't? What's the evidence? After the break, we're going to hear from Robert Livingston. He's a diversity consultant to scores of Fortune 500 companies to add to this conversation. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Today we're talking about rethinking diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI training. Ibram Kendi is another big name in anti-racist activism and writing. He's the founding director of the Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research and a New York Times best-selling author of 6 books, including How to Be an Anti-Racist. In 2020, Time magazine named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world. He argues that the opposite of racist isn't not racist, but anti-racist, and emphasizes the importance of dismantling racist policies. Here's Ibram Kendi speaking at the Aspen Ideas Festival in 2019.
Anti-racist ideas suggest that the racial groups are equals. Racist ideas suggest that certain racial groups are superior or inferior, better or worse than others. Racist policies yield racial inequity. Anti-racist policies yield racial equity. Racist people are people who are expressing racist ideas or are supporting racist policies with their action or even inaction.
We've been talking with Frank Dobbin. He's chair of the Department of Sociology at Harvard University and author of the book, co-author of the book, Getting to Diversity, What Works and What Doesn't, which was published in 2022. Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Robert Livingston is a diversity consultant who's worked with dozens of Fortune 500 companies and organizations. He's also a social psychologist at the Harvard Kennedy School. And Robert Livingston, great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So let me just start. I know you've been patiently sitting in the studio, which I'm grateful for. You've listened to Frank Dobbin's critique of some of this. Give me your reaction to what he said, including this idea that there's little evidence that a lot of mandatory DEI training doesn't work.
I agree with the evidence, and I've read Frank's work, and I respect Frank and have known him for several years. But I think a lot of this evidence depends on what you measure and how you measure it. So, you know, if a dependent variable is, did you like the training? And you got someone who really doesn't want to be there, well, it's not surprising they're not going to like the training. And I think, in fact, that could be evidence that you're putting them in the learning zone, because learning happens when people become uncomfortable. If they're too comfortable, then you haven't taken them outside of the comfort zone. And the learning zone is between the comfort zone and the danger zone. So like Frank, I think what you really have to focus on is the extent to which the organization moves the needle on indicators that are of interest to the organization.
So could you say a little bit more about that? Because that's sort of a basic question. And I asked Frank this question. What are we trying to accomplish here? Mm-hmm. I mean, in other words, I feel like we should know the answer to this, but I think it's still useful to sort of back up. What is or should the goal of DEI training be?
Well, I think that answer depends entirely on the organization and where they are. And so there are some organizations that aspire to increase the representation of diverse individuals, however they define that, within the organization. And that's what we call diversity. So they're really trying to get additional warm bodies that are not white males into the organization. Some have diversity already, and what they're trying to increase is inclusion and the feeling that people can bring their authentic selves to work. Some have both. I'm actually working with a government organization now where people feel like they belong, and there are actually more people of color than white people, but you have extreme differences in what we call equity, that all of the high-level managerial and executive positions are occupied by white people. So it really depends on, you know, the particular organization and the specific challenge that they're dealing with, and they have to be able to identify it, because you can't solve a problem until you can identify the problem.
So this is interesting. So it sounds like what you're saying is that companies might have different challenges mm-hmm. around diversity, equity, and inclusion. They should think hard about what those are and design or bring in a consultant or a program that responds to that particular thing. And the danger seems to be, and Frank Dobbin referred to this, is that instead, what might be happening in some or many cases, they're checking a box and sort of bringing in a program. So I guess the question is, you know, what do you see out there? Are most companies doing it the right way, or are most companies sort of checking that box?
So, you know, in my book, I talk about three types of people and four types of organizations. The three types of people are dolphins, ostriches, and sharks. Dolphins truly intrinsically care about racial justice, and they want to do the right thing, and they want to treat everyone equitably.
I love that. I love dolphins.
Okay, I do too, especially, you know, this analogy between the dolphins and humans who embrace social justice. The second is ostriches. They just bury their heads in the sand. They don't really care one way or the other. They're not invested in social justice. They're not against it. They're purely in pursuit of self-interest. And then you have sharks, and those are people who actually want there to be a social hierarchy. They want it to persist. And they are willing to invest time, effort, and energy into preserving the social hierarchy. Most people think that everybody's a dolphin, and that's absolutely not true. Research shows that less than 50% of people are dolphins. And as Frank mentioned, those are the ones that respond positively to white fragility trainings. So you sort of have to have people who have a certain degree of investment in doing better. Ostriches don't care. Sharks actually want there to be social hierarchy. So if that's the case, then, and the sharks are legally compelled to do it, they're going to check a box begrudgingly because they want their organization to be an old boys club. Ostriches don't care one way or the other. And so I think it depends on the organization. And research suggests that about 46% of people are dolphins, even though most people assume that 98% of people are dolphins. It's just not true. Slightly less than half of the population really cares about social justice.
Interesting. I want to ask you about what kind of DEI training works best. And I just came across this quote of yours that sort of stood out that I just thought says a lot, and I'd love it if you could explain it. Focused on actions and behaviors rather than hearts and minds. What do you mean by that?
So imagine the CDC or the American, Medical Association, discovers incontrovertible evidence that eating Brussels sprouts 3 servings a day will reduce your risk of cancer to zero. Woohoo, that's great. There's only one problem. You despise the taste of Brussels sprouts. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, what can you do? Well, it's really hard by sheer force of will to overcome visceral reactions. You cannot compel yourself to like Brussels sprouts. If that were the case, I'd eat, broccoli and carrots and celery sticks instead of double chocolate fudge brownie cheesecake. But what you can do is compel yourself to eat Brussels sprouts. You can't really force yourself to like it, but you can force yourself to eat it. Mm. Now, here's the magic in that example. If you eat Brussels sprouts enough, you will acquire a taste for it and you will begin to like it. So I've kind of, in a really simple way, encapsulated the literature on this. It's really hard to get people to change their hearts and minds, especially when we're talking about unconscious or implicit attitudes. They're deeply embedded, they're deeply conditioned, and it's really hard by sheer force of will to just tell people, this is bad, don't do it. Just as it's hard to say Brussels sprouts are good, like them. You can't force yourself to like them, but you can't force yourself to eat them. And by eating them, you actually will grow to like them. And so the research has shown that trying too hard to focus on attitudes can actually backfire or at best be ineffective.
Which is sort of what Frank Dobbin was saying.
That's right. But if you force people to sort of engage in behaviors, and this is kind of the cognitive behavioral therapy too, fake it till you make it. If you actually engage in the behaviors, because I think that's what organizations are really interested in, is the discrimination, not the prejudice, because we make a distinction between that and the social sciences. Discrimination is what you do. Prejudice is what you think. And that's not even legally actionable, what you think. It's legal to not like someone. It's not legal to not hire someone.
I see.
So we're really focused on discrimination. And I think by getting people to engage in actions that are consistent with the equity the organizations want to obtain, you will downstream actually change the behaviors. But I think that's just the icing on the cake. I think focus on the actions.
And give me an example of an organization that should focus on the actions. What actions?
So again, it goes back to what the organization wants to accomplish. So if they want to have a greater representation of people of color, then they should focus on recruitment and hiring. If they want to have more inclusion, they should focus on the culture. So again, you have to match the sort of goal to the outcome that you want to obtain. One concrete example is an organization right here in Boston, Massport, that saw that there weren't very many people of color economically benefiting from the development projects in the Seaport District. And so they actually changed their policies. They didn't tell developers you have to embrace diversity. They just said, we're going to score you on diversity, how many subcontractors you have that are from different groups, whether the tenants in commercial spaces in your hotels are businesses of color. We're going to grade you on all that. And it's going to be 25% of your score. And this is for a $500 million project. So many developers, and I wrote a case on this at Harvard, pushed back and said, that really slowed us down because we were used to using the same guys we'd been using for the last 40 years, which were white Irish males here in Boston. But, this policy shift made us actually have to go out and see, are there any women-owned architecture firms? Are there any people of color who own structural engineering firms? And that really slowed us down. But we're glad we did it because, they were way better than these guys we've been using for the last, right? So it's, they actually focused on the behavior. They didn't focus on whether they wanted to do it or not.
Yeah.
But by doing it, and they actually, the guy who won the contract, John Moriarty, partnered with another black developer, Greg Janey, and it just that contact, because there's a lot of research on contact and positive effects. And he's been changed. And he's like, I'm really glad that we did that. So that's an example of an intervention that was more directed towards actions, policies, practices than hearts and minds.
Frank Dobbin, I'd love to get you back into this conversation and react to what you're hearing. This theory about this sort of central idea, focus on actions and behaviors rather than hearts and minds. What's your response to that? And is there something in the research that you've done that suggests that that's the way to go?
Well, this is exactly what our book, Getting to Diversity, is about. And I want to shout out Robert's book, The Conversation, which is really a terrific read. So in our book, what we're trying to figure out is, of all the things you could do, what actually works and what doesn't. And so we look at diversity training, but we look at 30 other programs that companies put in. And it is exactly as Robert says, and I'm a longtime fan of his work from long before he was here at Harvard. What our research shows is that if you get managers involved in trying to solve the problem instead of blaming them for it, the Brussels sprouts example is a good example. They get with the program pretty quickly. Like white male managers, if you ask them to try to recruit more broadly by going to Hispanically serving institutions to get management trainees, by going to historically black colleges, there's some resistance in the beginning, but we show very big positive effects of just targeted diversity initiative recruiting on what the managerial workforce looks like 5 or 10 years later. If you ask people to mentor people who are unlike them through a mentoring program that assigns a mentor to every person in the organization, especially people at lower levels who tend to be people of color, women, who often are just not part of mentoring programs, we see huge positive effects. So these kinds of programs are interventions that companies put into place willingly, that they're really addressing behavior. Can we get you to recruit more broadly? Can we get you to mentor more broadly? Huge. These two things have
rather
giant
than take on
effects.
A sort of sense of responsibility for historically baked in racial issues that we all know about and we should all accept, but for whatever reason, when this gets thrust in people's faces, sometimes they react in the wrong way or negatively, I should say.
Especially if they're blamed for being biased and they're taught about the law and how what they've been doing is against law. So, I mean, I'm 100% in support of what Robert said before. Getting people to change their behavior is really what changes what a workplace looks like, not their attitudes.
I want to ask you both about an event that I witnessed not long ago around these issues that left me wondering about sort of a different kind of approach that you're describing here. So let me throw this out to you. So this was... And it's not really about DEI training, but it was about attitudes, public attitudes. And so this was an exercise in small town government in New England that I witnessed recently. And the simple idea was a mission statement for the local community center, which had to be approved by the town. And the proposed statement talked about recognizing systemic racism and the role we all play in perpetuating it, which seemed pretty straightforward. But it turns out lots of people in this mostly white town hated the statement. They felt like they were being blamed. They pushed back. There was an acrimonious town meeting. It eventually approved it, but like one vote, and people were really, really angry and upset about it. And I walked away from this experience thinking, huh, so this is interesting, because the sense I got of this community is that it wasn't a community of racists, but as soon as you sort of said to them, you're partly responsible for this, people just were like, no. And I felt like that the town lost an opportunity to bring people along perhaps more willingly if the language had just been different. I'm not sure what the answer would have been. But Robert, let me come back to you just to respond to that.
Yeah. And I think this is maybe where we differ in opinion, because I don't really in my work like to walk on eggshells or sugarcoat things or somehow hide the fact that even though white people living today aren't necessarily culpable, right, for historic injustices, they're certainly the beneficiaries.
Right.
So even if you don't bear any direct culpability, I think you bear responsibility because you are a beneficiary. And I think that's contrary to how many people see America. They see it as this sort of level playing field, and everyone kind of starts out with the same opportunities. And I think that reflects a certain amount of ignorance about not only the history, but our current systems and structures, politically, socially, economically, et cetera.
Right.
So I think that is a message that people, whether they like it or not, and this is part of what I was saying about the growth, is in order to do this work well, you have to tell people things that they don't like.
Right.
And that's why in my book, the subtitle is How Seeking and Speaking the Truth About Racism Can Radically Transform Individuals and Organizations. I think the focus has to be on the truth, not on, you know, spoon-feeding people pleasant platitudes that are easy to digest.
But what about sort of Frank's idea, which seems to be more focus on concrete actions rather than attitudes?
Well, yeah, that's what I was saying. And that's my whole approach. And that was the sort of quote that you read from me.
Right.
But I thought your question was about
the small town
and their reaction to this sort of statement. And I think there's no way around it. Sooner or later, people are going to have to meet the truth and they're not going to like it.
Yeah. Frank Dobbin, sort of a final thought from you before we come up to the break about sort of the anecdote that I related. Any reaction to that?
Well, I think to go back to a point Robert made earlier, contact is often what's important here.
Yeah.
Like, how do you put people in contact with people that they don't usually come into contact with at work? One problem is that many workplaces are quite diverse if you look at everybody who works there. But if you look at particular work groups, who are you working with? They're often not very diverse. That's why putting people into a mentoring program where they're mentoring people unlike themselves is one of the best ways to change people's hearts and minds.
Frank Dobbin, chair of the Department of Sociology at Harvard University, co-author of the book Getting to Diversity, What Works and What Doesn't. Thank you so much for coming in today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
And Robert Livingston, diversity consultant to all kinds of companies and organizations. He's a social psychologist at Harvard Kennedy School. Robert, please stick around. We have another guest to introduce next break, and we'll continue this conversation. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Later this week, we're asking, can a dose of anxiety be good for us? Have you ever experienced a time when anxiety served a positive purpose in your life? Maybe it made you more productive or helped you grow in some way. How are you navigating, maybe even benefiting from anxiety? If you're willing, share your experience about anxiety with us, both good and bad, by leaving a message on the On Point Vox Pop app. If it's not on your phone already, just search for On Point Vox Pop wherever you get your apps. Or you can call this number and leave us a voicemail, 617-353-0683. Again, 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion training, whether it's effective and whether we need to rethink the way we do it. We're joined by Robert Livingston. He's a diversity consultant. He's a social psychologist at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He's author of the book, The Conversation, How Seeking and Speaking the Truth About Racism Can Radically Transform Individuals and Organizations. And in a moment, we're going to be hearing from Chloe Valdery, who's got a really interesting approach to this. But Robert, before we bring in Chloe, I just want to follow up something from the last break. It seems like that the success of DEI training, to a large extent, is going to depend on how seriously committed companies are to the process. In other words, are they truly committed to figuring out how to make change in their workplace around diversity, equity, and inclusion, or are they just checking that box? Mm-hmm. So how do you go about figuring that out?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in my book, and my book is actually structured on my press model, there's an HBR piece in 2020 where I talked about how to promote racial equity in the workplace. And I have this model. PRESS is an acronym for the five stages I think necessary. The first P, problem awareness. Is there even a problem? R, root cause analysis. Where does it come from? E, empathy or concern. Do I care enough to want to do something about it? And then you get to S, which is strategy. Organizations want to jump straight to S. Almost invariably when I have, you know, my initial conversations with organizations, they say, just tell us what to do without going through those first three stages. And then the fifth the stage or the second S is sacrifice. Once I tell you what to do, are you actually willing to do it? Are you actually willing to invest the time, the effort, the energy, the resources? Because any strategy is worthless without implementation. So that's how I think, you know, step by step, you sort of get to it. And so to answer your question, if an organization doesn't care, then you never get to strategy. Strategy assumes that there is a certain amount of investment in doing something about the problem. For them, the strategy is just making it disappear, or hence the box ticking, and it's not a real, genuine approach to solving the problem.
Got it. So let me introduce another voice into this conversation, Chloe Valdery. She's the CEO of The Theory of Enchantment, a diversity and inclusion program that focuses its training on love, among other things. And Chloe Valdery, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's really good to have you. So your website lists clients. They include TikTok, WeWork, the Federal Aviation Administration, and Greenwich High School. And I was reading a really interesting article about your program, and it points out that your website asks potential customers a loaded question: looking for an anti-racism program that actually fights bigotry instead of spreading it? So let's start there. Sure. I'd love you to just sort of explain that provocative statement there.
Yeah, I think that a lot of our partners were feeling very much under attack by bringing in, or when bringing in, programs that perhaps centered, for example, a Robin DiAngelo-style approach to DEI, an approach that where the facilitator would tell folks, depending upon their background, depending upon their skin color, things like, you know, you are privileged, or things like you are underprivileged, either explicitly or implicitly. And oftentimes in facilitation, that would actually result in a sense of fracturing between groups of different ethnic backgrounds. And it would also result in, instead of this coming together of people from different backgrounds, which I totally agree with, it would result in a kind of self-segregation. People would feel like they couldn't empathize with other people, and they would also assume different things about the lived experiences of others. And so many of our partners and clients were coming to us feeling like these are the only types of DEI programs that are in the market today. We are looking for something else, something as an alternative. And at that point, I had already developed a curriculum that taught and focused on what Dr. King called the beloved community, which really centers agape love, unconditional love, which Dr. King said was the aim of the civil rights movement, right? Which centered that as the sort of organizing principle around which to fight for equity, equality, et cetera.
Interesting. Chloe, hang on. We actually have tape from Dr. King talking about this idea of agape. So let's listen. This is Dr. King's Love Your Enemy sermon from 1957 in Montgomery, Alabama, where he talked about the idea.
Agape is something of the understanding, creative, redemptive goodwill for all men. It is a love that seeks nothing in return. It is an overflowing love. It's what theologians would call the love of God working in the lives of men. And when you rise to love on this level, you begin to love men not because they are likable, but because God loves them.
So, Chloe Valdery, I'm reading about the principles that guide your coursework. One, treat people like human beings, not political abstractions. Criticize to uplift and empower, never to tear down, never to destroy. And three, root everything you do in love and compassion. So what does that end up looking like as a DEI training program?
So it looks like really trying to give organizations an ecology of practices. We, you know, I heard you guys talking about training earlier and how training is often, you know, a 15-minute sort of implicit bias test. But Theory of Enchantment is actually about giving folks long-term practices that they can then use those practices to build their systems within their company around. And with this, we're actually talking about multi-year partnerships. This kind of way of being that's centered around agape love, does not happen overnight, and it can't happen overnight because, you know, we are all susceptible to bias. We are all susceptible to self-deception. And the only way we can actually help to counter that or even strive to counter that is by practicing. And so I'll give you an example. Treat people like human beings, not political abstractions. Well, we ask the question, what does it mean to be a human being? One of the practices that we give people is called the Who Am I practice, where they actually ask themselves, who am I? And for everything that comes to them, whether positive or negative, they are asked to say thank you. They're asked to express gratitude for the complexity of their being. Why is that important? Because when we stereotype others, we are simultaneously stereotyping ourselves. So if I am walking around thinking that a group of people are, for example, lazy, right? I stereotype another ethnic group as lazy. I am denying the fact that in certain contexts, I am lazy. And if I don't make peace or come into right relationship with that aspect of my identity, if I am suppressing that or ashamed of that, I am far more likely to unconsciously project it onto other people who do not look like me. So we give people that Who Am I practice. We introduce people to the Who Am I practice, and we also encourage them to practice it on a regular basis. So once a week, for example. This is just one example of many practices that we give, especially in our online curriculum, that again is all about this awareness that we are all susceptible to bias, we are all prone to self-deception, and the only way to sort of work through that, and it is a lifetime practice, the only way to work through that is not by, you know, memorizing a set of propositions, but by actually committing to a discipline.
Mm. One of the pop culture references that you use in your theory of enchantment training, Chloe, is from an interview the rapper Jay-Z did with the New York Times in 2017, where he talked about his experience going to therapy. So I want to play a clip from that.
Every emotion is connected and comes from somewhere. You know, you realize that, you know, if someone's racist toward you, it's not even about you. It ain't about you. It's about their upbringing and what happened to them and how they led them to this point. There was a lot of fights in our neighborhood that started with, what you looking at? Why you looking at me? You looking at me? And then you realize, oh, you think I see you. You're in a space where you're hurting and you think I see you, so you don't want me to look at you. Knowing that and understanding that changes life completely.
So, Chloe, sort of expand on that a little bit about the profundity of what Jay-Z is talking about there.
Yeah, so I mean, this goes to something that we try to teach people about supremacy. People think that supremacy is this kind of mysterious thing whereby a person really actually thinks that they're better than another human being. But if you were to look into the psychology of supremacy and a supremacist tendency, someone acting out of a supremacist tendency 9 times out of 10 actually feels an incredibly strong inferiority complex. And which is to say a deep sense of a lack of self-worth, and is overcompensating by projecting this kind of, I'm better than you, I'm bigger than you, I'm holier than you, etc. This is, you know, what's known, I think, in psychology as splitting. And splitting is this mechanism by which we as human beings will see the world in black and white. Figuratively and literally speaking, we will say, oh, all those people, you know, if we are experiencing scarcity, let's say some sort of material scarcity and or psychological scarcity, and we don't have the tools to deal with that, we will drop into splitting. And we will say, all the people over there who look like me are good, and all the people over here who don't look like me are bad. It's a heuristic, and it's a defensive mechanism used to bring about security into one's space. And that's basically what Jay-Z is getting at in explaining that. And so if you can, first of all, become aware of that, become aware of the fact of how you function as a human being, be aware of how the human condition is playing itself out in all aspects of your life, including the workplace. And if you can practice seeing through different lenses, then you can actually regulate that, calibrate that tendency. And we all have the tendency. Every one of us has the tendency because that's part of what it means to be human. But if we can become aware of that and practice different techniques, techniques to come out of that lens, we will be better off in the long run.
So, Chloe, I want to get Robert Livingston back in this conversation. I'd love it, Robert, if you could sort of respond to what you're hearing. And I also have a follow-up question to you, Chloe, about this.
Sure.
But I don't want to lose the wisdom we have here in the studio from Robert.
So I like the idea, and it's not an entirely new idea. I mean, as she mentioned, you know, with Dr. King, there's a lot of research on humanism, Carl Rogers in psychology. There's a long tradition of that from the 1950s. But in my work and in my book, I talk about how a lot of what we see and a lot of the roots of, aggression is insecurity. And that if you affirm people, that they actually become less prejudiced. And there's a lot of research on this. So if you make people feel better about themselves, they're less prejudiced. If you tell someone they failed a test, they become more racially prejudiced. Right. So there's a long history of sort of research on this. But I think I want to respond in two ways. One is, I think this word love or even agape gets tossed around, and there's a wonderful book by Bell Hooks called All About Love. And in the whole book, she spends, 150 pages explaining what love is. And the central thesis is that most people don't really understand what love is, even in their own lives. And one of the critical components to love is respect. And I think that's where a lot of this approach falls short for me, because we're not just talking about recognizing our common humanity and loving one another. I think there is a critical element of respect here that is necessary. And I think even Dr. King said, love without respect or love without power is anemic. So you don't want to turn yourself into a doormat in the service of love. And I think a lot of people interpret love as meaning that I'm going to love you regardless of what you do. And it's kind of this unconditional acceptance of behavior, some of which may even be unacceptable behaviors. But I think my other issue is, I just in my 25 years of experience in doing this, I have a hard time understanding how this can actually move the needle in organizations. Because as I mentioned before, there are three types of people, at least three: dolphins, ostriches, and sharks. And I can see this being wonderful for dolphins and
not so good for the ostriches.
Yeah. And
Let's let Chloe respond. And Chloe, the question I would add, and this comes from what Robert was talking about earlier, we've got to deal with hard truths, and sometimes dealing with hard truths is going to make people uncomfortable. Is there a place for hard truths that might make people uncomfortable and be necessary to move the needle here?
Yes, and I think it is a kind of common theme to assume that love means not being honest with people or not being truthful or direct with people when they mess up. But the second principle of the theory of enchantment is criticize to uplift and empower, never to tear down or destroy. So that act of being critical when criticism is required is actually built into the framework. But there's also this piece about respect that I agree with. But I think what theory of enchantment is trying to get to the heart of is that often people are not respectful of others, in part because they lack their own sense of self-respect. And I will say that theory of enchantment is obviously a much more, bottom-up approach. And I do think that in order to accomplish some of the things that we were talked about earlier, you need both a top-down and a bottom-up approach. So, I'm a huge fan of ideas like mentorship programs. I mean, I'm in many ways, my career is the product of mentorship programs. So I do believe that structurally things should take on that shape and form. But I want to bring up a critique that Derek Bell, the father of critical race theory, actually brought up when it comes to top-down approaches that actually, because the ecosystem is not fervent, won't actually work. Derek Bell actually critiqued that in his book Silent Covenants, and that's worth thinking about.
All right. Well, on that thought, we're going to have to end the hour. I feel like we just scratched the surface here, but Chloe Valdery, CEO of anti-racism training organization Theory of Enchantment, thank you so much for joining us. I'm very grateful.
Thank you.
And Robert Livingston, diversity consultant and social psychologist at the Harvard Kennedy School He's author of The Conversation, How Seeking and Speaking the Truth About Racism Can Radically Transform Individuals and Organizations. Thank you. I really appreciate having you this hour.
Thank you for having me.
That's it. I'm Anthony Brooks. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.